We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. As always, when you have a moment, check out the Muse headband at choosemuse.com. Today, we have another encore from Ariel. Here we go.
Welcome to another Untangle. We know that music can shift our energy on demand, organize our thoughts, stimulate our body to move, reset our emotional state, and allow us to pass through the day in a more relaxed and harmonious manner. Why music affects us the way it does remains somewhat of a beautiful mystery, but there's no doubt that it does affect us. Today, we're going to dive deeper into music's mystery with our guest and the author of those beautiful words above, Frank Fitzpatrick. Frank is an unbelievable musician. He's a multi-platinum selling record producer, Grammy-nominated songwriter. He's produced Hollywood scores and pop music alike. He's an expert in music and health, and he's also a meditator and dear friend. He's written a beautiful book about music called Amplified, through which he shares his deep understanding of the construction and power of music to help others access that power and to help you fall further in love with it. Frank is here today to share his understanding of how music can transform our lives and how we can use it as a tool to access our emotional, practical, and spiritual growth. Welcome, Frank.
Hi, Ariel. It's great to be here. It's really exciting to spend some time with you again and to share with your audience. I'm really excited about this.
I'm really excited about this too, because you're one of the people who has the deepest connection to music and how it moves us that I know.
You know a lot about music, so that's a nice big compliment. So thank you.
Before we started, you actually were playing me a piece of music, and I'm wondering if we can actually start just diving into some sounds and talking about the experience of them.
Well, let me touch upon something on the piano. Now, I'm not a pianist, but I do write for the piano, so I use the piano also as a meditative tool and to put me into a state and to shift my state in different times in the day. So I'm going to play from the perspective of not performing. I'll just play a little bit of maybe what I would do to do that for myself. And it'll also be a snippet of something I've written. And this is sometimes how songs come through me and become written and go on. So I'll just share that just to give you a little context. And so I'm going to treat it more as you can't see me, but as though as I'm almost meditating in front of you. And we'll see what translates. And so I would invite you to let the music come into you in a different way. Just receive it as a gift and just pay attention to your breath and see how it shifts with something within you if it does.
Beautiful. And it definitely shifted me. So thank you for playing for all of us listening. For me, I think when you first started, I actually felt really emotional, like a sadness, like the beginning of the playing, like loosened a sadness inside of me. And then when the high notes started to come in and you started to go up the scale, it brought in the sense of optimism. And then the notes that you sustained dropping the next note where there was an elongated pause, it also brought out a sense of melancholy, but like of time extending, like long summer nights, long summer days. And then at the end, as you brought us lighter and lighter and lighter, I became more and more at ease and resolved. And then you had that funny note right at the end when you didn't totally harmonize, when you were a little bit off, and that awakened me in a sense, and then left me in this light place with these very high notes at the end. So I certainly emoted through it and transformed from it.
What a beautiful description of a listening experience. You're obviously deeply listening. And isn't it amazing how, as a neuroscientist, you know, like the link between perceptions and emotions and thoughts that come up and how they feed off of each other. But isn't it amazing how music can take you through? That was probably, a minute? And so the range that you could go through in a minute by the music taking you there, that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and the emotions that it evokes and the range of associations that become both evoked and created through this very short piece of music. And I totally admit, had I not really been listening, and music often just goes in the background and you're not really listening, it's just there coloring your day. But the invitation to listen deeply was what allowed the emotional processing and shifts and associations to be happening. So thank you for that rare invitation to just listen deeply.
Well, thank you. We'll dive a little bit more into that, to the unconsciousness of listening and what it does, and how out of all our senses, it's the one we're least conscious of, and it's the one that never turns off. So it's an interesting dynamic when we get into it a little deeper, and I'm sure we'll do that in the next little bit. I'm excited about that. For people, if they want to know, there is a beautiful performance of that by another pianist on my album, and it's called Timeless Love, the track, and it's on a 20th anniversary tribute, a solo piano album of mine. So they can find it anywhere, Spotify, wherever you get your music. So they can listen to it at full length and beautifully performed, and many others like it.
You did not start out in this world as a natural player of music or someone with a natural affinity for music. Can we actually start just with your own story and how you came to this world?
Sure. I'm not of a musical family, and I wasn't raised with musical training like many of the people I work with and many people we know. But I grew up in an incredibly musical city. I grew up in the city of Detroit in the 60s and the 70s. And Detroit at that time, among being like the Silicon Valley of America with technology and the auto industry and the number one middle class city of the world and full employment and just a great place to live in the early 60s. And we'll get to the next episode. But it was also the home of Motown Records. So it was the first place to put R&B and soul music on the global map. And just, you know, I grew up listening to the Stevie Wonder and the Jackson 5. And then it was kind of a mega center for rock and roll bands from both Europe and America to come through. So the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, these are all kind of influences I had. I had five older brothers starting about 3 years up from me. So I got exposed to music of artists as we usually do by people who influence us and we want to both emulate and differentiate ourselves from. So that kind of shaped my musical identity. And so I loved music. And then things kind of shifted in Detroit around 1971, 72. I was 11 years old and it was became what it like it looked at in the middle of COVID in many places. As Detroit went through a massive collapse. And it went from full employment, richest middle-class city in the world, to 30% unemployment. 1 million people left the city because of white flight, because it was the first city to do forced busing for desegregation in the schools. And the auto industry collapsed, and most of that money left. And there was a very corrupt government. My schools shut down because I was in a public school system. So suddenly, I'm spending most of my time on the streets and not in a healthy way. And I can honestly say in this conversation, I've said it before, that you and I wouldn't be friends today and we wouldn't be having this conversation now because I wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for music. It really became, at 11, 12 years old, it became my drug of choice. And by the time I was 13, 14, I had friends dying of heroin and many other less fortunate drugs. And I decided, I remember this seminal moment, and we had a big family. I come from a family of nine, so we had to share everything. There was one stereo in the living room. There was one pair of headphones, and it had a cord attached to it. So I remember, and I usually got to use it after everybody was asleep. So I was up late at night, and I was laying down on the living room floor with the headphones on, and Marvin Gaye shouting his new hit in my ears, "What's Going On?" And I was just feeling like the world is just so upside down. I don't know where to go. And it just resonated with me so deeply that his words is as if they were coming from my brain. It wasn't like I was listening to something externally. It was like my soul was singing to me. And see, it comes up now. I get emotional even now. So
I'm getting emotional. It's one of my favorite songs. I cry every time I hear it.
So I made a commitment then at 12 years old that my mission in the world was going to help kids all over the world and people use music as a way to get through the toughest challenges of their lives. And that's been a calling of mine, and I don't think it's going to let go of me. So it led to the book we're going to talk about. It led to many other things in my career and my life that we'll get into. But that was really the impetus of when I was younger. And then I was from 12 on, because I had these older brothers, between 11 and 12, I started working full time. I was kind of disenchanted with childhood, and I would save my money and go to concerts. And concerts in Detroit at that time meant seeing The Who 1 week, The Rolling Stones the next week, Pink Floyd the next week, The Temptations, Diana Ross, The Jackson 5, just on and on. Kind of every legacy, 60s and 70s, legacy rock and R&B and soul artists. By the time I was 18 or 19 years old, I'd kind of experienced. So that was really my music education. I did go to music, take composition, and I got a music degree in college as one of my degrees because I knew the path I was going on. But earlier in life, I wouldn't say denied, but I was turned down. I was told I was no good to pursue music. I didn't have the talent to do it at very, very young age. So I just pursued mostly as a fan. I would play in some bands with friends. It was like I never really envisioned that it would be such a big part of my life and that I would have such a major role in bringing it to the world and a major responsibility in bringing it to the world, and because I know what can be done with it now.
I recall in your book saying that at the age of 10, your teacher said that you did not have the talent to play the flute and you were denied. I found that an incredibly inspiring story for everybody who feels like they're not talented at music, yet they're allowed to love it and create it and be within it.
Yeah, one of the things that is really important to me in my work, and I've been running this global campaign for years through my nonprofit, but also in the book, is just I'm really committed to helping people change their relationship to and with music. Because over the last 500 years of development of Western society, and I won't go into the whole history of, I've done that before, but I won't do that on this. So we'll never get
to the end of our podcast and to the other subjects.
But basically, we've narrowed the way that our relationship with music into two very narrow paths. And one is commodity and the other is performance. And so commodity is because you want to go on and you want to make money as a star or an artist or sell records. And performance is because all the training that we receive around music is to have us be performers. And it's funny because we let kids play sports, but they don't actually have to go for the MBA. And if they don't get it, some of them do and they get disappointed. And in music, I always thought we should teach music like we do meditation. You could take somebody in, like let them receive, give them the tools to open up to receive music, not to put music out. So I do an exercise in the book called The Black Notes, where I can teach anybody to play the piano in less than 10 minutes and to meditate while they play the piano. But it's all really about receiving the music and letting the music show up for you. So the juxtaposition I came to in our relationship with music was always there, and it's there for you, and you start to recognize it. It's that you and I are the instruments. The listener, you are the instrument. And music is there like your breath to play through you. Your DNA knows it. It recognizes it. It relates to it in certain ways. Creates a whole subconscious narrative for you. It changes the narrative of anything you're looking at. There's so many areas we can get into, but music is already a gift that's given to us. It's not something we have to earn or show up or learn to do. So I want to break that down for people, because so many people are cut off. People have a hard time, even if they played music, took lessons for 15 years at violin, and they didn't make the first chair, and they kind of gave it up and put it in the closet for the next 20. Like a 10-year-old boy like me, and I didn't get to have a free instrument because they said I wasn't good enough to be able to learn the flute. So people get cut off because they're judged on their capacity to be a performer, which means you're really judged on your capacity to be a professional in the field and create income out of it. And that's not why music was previous to 500 years around. It was part of everything we did. It was the medicine man was the musician. In China, music and happiness and medicine are almost all the same symbol, because it was basically people would use it to build relationships. They would use it to birth children. They would use it to transition at the end of life. They would use it to communicate with each other before there was even spoken language. So we kind of have lost these precious, precious, precious resources that are always there for us. So that's really, music is the gift, but really you, the listener, you who's hearing this, and you, Ariel, you are the gift and you are the instrument. And music is just here to help you bring that gift to life and help it shine and resonate with well-being and deep loving connection and intimacy into the world and to yourself.
That's incredibly beautiful. And for some people, what you're saying will resonate deeply and will be like, yes, I know, I get it, I feel it. And for some people hearing it, it's like, that's a beautiful concept, but what does that mean and how do I access it? Can you give us some of the tools or entreways that we can begin to use to feel or understand those sensations, that depth?
Let me talk about a couple simple ones, and then maybe we'll go through a couple. The book is set up in the beginning and gets us into shifting that relationship around music, and it gives examples and stories and lots of neuroscience for you science heads and biology and everything else. And then the second part is really around a toolkit and how you can really practically use it in your life, because this is what I see that we're not taught. So think of it as music appreciation 2.0, 3.0 or something. So there are things you can do.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
One that I use with my high performance clients and stuff is basically is structuring your music into a functional way. Because this computer in your pocket, this, whether it be the iPhone or whatever it is, this brilliant computer in your pocket has all these resources available at your fingertip anytime you need it. So if you're need a way to communicate in a relationship. You need a way to build relationships. You need a way to create what we call in peak performance, high performance, double down on that neural stack and add another layer so you can take yourself to another level of performance, whether you're going for the gold for the Olympics or just trying to get through a struggling entrepreneurs or mothers dealing with their children day. These are ways. So let me just touch on a couple of practical ones as you asked. So one piece I do is I call it the power playlist. So I have people build a power playlist. I break it down into this acronym called FIRM. And I say, start to set up your music in your library that you can quickly go to something that allows you to do at least these four or five things. And so for FIRM, F is focus, and we all need help focusing. So we can use music and our soundscapes to focus. The idea is to have those at hand so you can just start to craft those. There's lots of sources you can go to. There's actually apps like our friends at Focus at Will, or there's actually lots of on Spotify or iTunes. You could go through 150 focus playlists. You've created some in your work that are fantastic. Just have the one that works for you personally in each of these areas. And I'll talk a little bit more about preference and why that's so important. At your fingertips so that you go, okay, I'm distracted, I'm not productive, I need to be more focused, I need more present, that you can just, okay, let me connect this to another practice and stack it with a couple of deep breaths and go into this and then go into a deep work session. So that's focus is one. The second one is inspiration, the I in FIRM. And we all have music that inspires us. But I really invite you to really create the playlist by the feeling and energy you want to create within your system and how you want to feel at the end of it or within it or while you're going through it, as opposed to just things that you would, I like this, I don't like this, this is my favorite artist. But really pay attention to all of your choices by what they're communicating to you and what you're actually feeling and what they're actually doing to your system, very much as Ariel, you described to the audience in Dream While I Was Playing the Piano. When you tuned into it, you knew, you were very clear. And you would know, okay, that really helps me do X. Let me add this to that list. And I can come back to it, because the more you come back to it, the more your mind will connect it to those feelings you want to have. So it's a very powerful tool. Then the next one is R in FIRM is relaxation. So I actually have one of those that I build for an hour wind down for sleep preparation. So I usually have people do that in their daily practices, their PM bookend, as we say. Or it could be something when you come home from work and you just need 15 minutes to shift the energy. But you have it already built. It's a go-to and you're updating it as you discover new stuff. That can also be for some people used as an alternative to meditation or as part of their meditation, but meditation can be more specific. And then the M is a motivation. So that's usually different from inspiration because we're trying to activate the motor cortex and music's and emotions.
Get your motor running. Boom,
boom, boom. Yeah, so we want to get you moving. And music will activate your motor cortex. It's at the connection of the emotion, part of where the emotions activate in the brain. And we can use it for many great things, for helping with stride, with Parkinson's and other things, because it does that. But in your own life, you can use it to go out on your jog, to work out at the gym, so I call it motivation, but you might call it movement. And then if we double up the M, we come back to meditation. So music is a very powerful way to help people both move into meditation, sit in meditation, because what you're doing is you're creating basically a sonic temple and you're immersing yourself in this sonic temple and it can create a base. Now, not all meditation needs music. It depends what your practice is, but I use it very actively in my meditation and very purposefully. And I find, again, as we talk about those neural stacks, as Kotler would talk about in The Art of Impossible or Peak Performance or Flow, it adds a layer of a neural stacks. And it also helps you to ground, providing you're doing the music that actually does do that for you. So those are the areas that if I was working with somebody personally, or what I do in the book, is recommend that people set up at least those. You may have many more. If we have time, I can walk through the soundtrack to my morning.
Can we hear it? I would love to hear it, because as you're describing the FIRM, I have songs that are coming to mind that would work for me, particularly for inspiration, but I'm still limited in just the songs that I can recall. I'd love to know what a professional uses, what you recommend.
Right. Well, okay. Yeah, I'll do a little bit of a walkthrough on what my morning ritual is and how I score my morning, or I move through my morning. practice and rituals to music. And it's timed and it keeps me on track and I can go through that. But I do want to say something about preference before we get into it, because you kind of brought it up again, because you are the professional of your knowledge of how music affects you. You might not have the broadest range for curation of what might get you there. But in terms of the ultimate deciding factor, it is really tuning into your energy fields, your emotion, your breath, and the same way you would in the work that you're doing with, have done with Muse and the other work you're doing. It's like, even if you can't see it on the screen, it's not getting measured on an app, which we'll talk about later with hearables, but you can feel it. You can start to tune into your body and how we listen with the whole body and how we resonate with that. So preference, no matter what the studies are, like the book is very vetted and has some great neuroscientists involved, but no matter what the studies are, preference is a huge part of the effect. It's just like, I remember you were talking with Dave Eagleman and on your other podcast, and it's like memory. Memory is not exact. It's built into this huge frame of context of our experiences, right? And so music is very much the same. It's built into this huge frame of context of subconscious experiences. So what might help you to meditate might annoy somebody else and vice versa. What might get you all want to get up and dance might, you know, not be for somebody else. We see this between generations pretty regularly. And so I just want to honor your own preferences. If it works for you, it works for you. Doesn't matter. The experiment is you and you're the instrument. So with that premise, so that I don't want anybody, even yourself, to feel like you're doing anything wrong. We're here living this life experience. It's just an exploratory experience where we're just trying to learn and to learn and to grow and to learn and to grow and try and try, right? So there's no wrong choices. And then you'll know if it's wrong.
There's no wrong notes.
Right. There's no wrong for you. And even, yes, the wrong note at the end wasn't a wrong note. It was very intentional, as it was a leading tone into where I wanted you to land. So these kind of things are, you want to feel the, each of these things yourself and use yourself as you are the lab. So anyways, let me see if I can do this in a practical way. I'm going to play some snippets. So this is how I architect my morning with music. So the first thing is, if you have an alarm clock and it has an alarm, please throw it away or change it to something that has a softer, more gentle entry into the day. And if you need it to get louder to get you out of bed because you need that, then just allow it to get louder. There's a lot of ways to do that. So I'll just share you what I do. So I wake up to, I have my cell phone in the bathroom near my bedroom, but I can still hear it. And I wake up with a piece that brings me gently into the day, and I'll play just a snippet of it. So this is my alarm clock, but it's my non-alarm wake up. I'm going to cheat a little and pull out of these. So I'm sorry for this. It's a terrible thing to have to do to people. So that's just to get me out of bed. So as soon as I'm out of bed, I go get up, go wash my face. And then I start into my morning, what I call my morning ritual. And I'll start to play this in the background. And so it's timed for me. So basically, I have a 11, 12 minute structure to get me through a number of rituals before I'm at my meditation, at a sitting meditation on my balcony, looking out at nature in front of my altar. So this is the transition from waking, getting that first step out of bed. And I'll tell you some of the stuff as it's playing in the background. That first piece was a piece by me. The second piece is by Peter Cater. And it's a beautiful piece called Wandering. So here we go. So at this point, my morning ritual consists of getting up, washing my face, making my bed, and then going and drinking some lemon water and to start the digestive system going. I'll do a set of stretches. And that'll take a little bit of time. You know, I'll get dressed. And this will be playing in the background. And then I have about a 12-minute sequence that I know, okay, I'm up. I could climb back in bed, but I got this 12-minute piece that I'm going to gracefully move through a fixed set of time to move myself into the day like the sun rises into nature. And so I'll skip a little forward in this. I don't typically, like, for sake of time. And so you'll see it's kind of timeless. The music is not very structured. I'm not quite into a rhythm. I'm not quite into a rhythm section or any of that. It's still very much kind of holding on to that deeper, moving as I'm moving out of a delta state, trying to move into that more, stay in that more relaxed brain state. So I can move gracefully into my meditation. So I'm not looking at my phone. I'm not looking at any emails, texts, just nothing happens except for my morning ritual leading into my meditation until I go ideally into deep work for, you know, 90 minutes or something after I come out of this, after about 35 minutes. So the next piece I'll give you a little taste of, because for two reasons, I had to extend that because I'm a little slow in the morning. So to get all those things done, this is the piece I played at the beginning. So this is the recording. And I'll go forward a little bit. All right, so now I've stretched. It's got a little bit more motion. It's lifted me up. I'm a little bit more awake. You can see it's got a tempo to it, even though it's still very open time. It doesn't have a fixed metric time. It has a very variable time, is what we would call in music. And then I'm into my meditation. I'm seated now. I've stretched. I've done everything. I do a pretty solid series of preparations for my meditation, so I consider it all one piece. I'm meditating from the moment my eyes open through all this process in a way, but now I'm actually sitting, legs crossed on a stool in front of my altar, looking out at outside. And so I create a sonic temple that goes with the candles, that goes with the environment, so I can transport myself into a space beyond the physical plane of which I'm sitting in. And I'll just nip through some of this and so this is again by Peter Cater. It's a beautiful piece called Heaven's Window. And throughout this, I'll do a series of pranayama exercises, which is breathing exercises for those who are not familiar with that term. But I do a pretty deep set of ritual breathing exercises, basically to get my lungs open up, to get my brain open up, to get my left-right hemisphere start to be more activated and connected. And so this is that preparation. And then I go into another phase of my meditation. This takes about 8 minutes. And then I go into, it's a bit of, for some people, it's called energy meditation, energy center meditation, activation. It's basically an activation, integration of the chakras and the energy centers of the body. If you don't like that word, we could use a more medical term, but it's to really integrate and create coherence. And this is at the point where I commit to the soul force that I'm embodying that day. Because when we go to sleep at night, if we put it in a spiritual context, we forget who we are. So part of the reason we meditate in the morning is to remind us who we are. And to remind us the world that we live in and the experience that we live in that's much bigger than this thing we just think we woke up to. And to connect to that so that we can go through a day with... So this is how I... Basically what I say is I re-embody my soul. I make my body and prepare myself to be worthy to represent this calling that comes into me so I can move through my day. And then that's about a 9-minute piece. I use breathing with my meditation, then I use visualization about, and I send gratitude out to the people I, and love out to the people who need my support and gratitude for other things in my life. And then I go to another piece, and these are both with Satnam Kaur, beautiful voice. Now I'm up and stretching. I have a, you know, you could call it like an asana practice, but it's more of a, what I call an integrated intelligence practice, where I bring together all these elements of music, sound, movement, stretching, and the breath and music, and then really fully embody and get myself in strong in the three areas that I really want to excel in that day, which is vitality or energy, abundance, and love. So this takes me through that, and that's about a 6-minute exercise, and then I'm basically done with that sequence. I'm off. I'm ready. I'm a whole new person. I swear to God, I'm a completely different person than who woke up when that 35 minutes ago. I'm just a completely different person. And then if I want, I'll go now prepare my morning smoothie and a cup of tea so I can go into a deep work mode. And provided I don't distract myself with texts or emails, I can go into a pretty long, deep work mode after doing that with a real clear focus and intention. But while I'm preparing like the smoothie and getting ready for that, I might do something that's a little bit more up. And this is a piece that I created with a team out of Toronto, actually, that was for a campaign for Starbucks to help people use music to wake up better. So we did it. I think I went through like 75 studies and created guidelines for composers who write music for this purpose, but it was really okay. And this one is more, as you see, it's going to get right into now we're getting into more pop, more inspiring lyrics, more, this would be more on my inspiration list. So the previous stuff would have been more on my meditation list. This is definitely, I got a list of songs that if I want to go for a morning run as part of this, if I want to just get a little bit of energy going and move around a little bit before I go into the deep work sitting mode, I might run this. And it's a pretty big shift, as you can tell from, so I don't get into the, if I stay in that other mode of the meditation music, I'm just probably not really going to want to do that much work. And I probably want to hang out and with nature. And so I got to shift into a more inspired motivation, a little bit more practical steps with my brain and my system. We just ran through in 5 minutes, but it's a 40-minute ritual. So yeah.
I love that shift. When you got into the last piece, yes, I know you wrote it for Starbucks, but you wrote it with the intention of understanding all of the things that are going to make music make your morning feel up. And it really worked for me. So I was quite dreamy after the last set of pieces. I was in this very easy, loose state, almost liminal and like just pleased. And then as soon as you put on the last piece, my body started moving and it could not help it. I'm like moving with the rhythm. I'm bopping my head. My eyes are becoming alert. I'm like, yeah. It's funny, for how much I love and care about music, I've never thought about using it so intentionally in this way to shift mood. And, you know, I do a million things to shift mood and shift state. I have hypnotherapy tapes. I perfuse myself with feelings of love. I shift my sensation all the time. It's like it's a ninja skill that I like to exert. And for some reason, it hasn't occurred to me in this way to use music this intentionally. And it's such a powerful tool. I mean, you just demonstrated the power of how one moment I can be in this beautiful floaty state and the next I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Right. Well, you weren't taught. Nobody's taught. It's an unfortunate state that I'm doing what I can to shift it and help people do that. And it's an important mission to me. And I hope to help a lot of people do the same, but we're just not taught. So it's, I mean, you're brilliant knowing what affects the mind and what affects the emotions. You're very in touch. You built a business around how these things, and mainly coming from your own deep knowing of yourself. And also you love music, but yes, there's still, this is an example of even somebody who has all those things up on a 10 and you know they go together.
Not practically implementing it.
You haven't had any practical guidance on how to practically implement it. And when you do, I kind of go back to Kotler's work or the flow work or a lot of colleagues work on. To me, when I do that work, it's like man, it's such a layer of like a secret ingredient to the neuro stack that people are so missing in their menus that I just don't know how they can cook that way.
So it's like, been missing salt all this time and you just didn't know it.
Missing seasoning. Right? Years ago, it's funny because when I started this global campaign and I was doing a lot with speaking, trying to get music into education for kids and development, and I was really pissed at all these great leaders. I won't mention their names, and people who are doing amazing stuff in the world and had big voices, but they just didn't, again, there was just such a disconnect. So they remove music from everything instead of going the other way. They remove music from health. They remove music from education. And I said, well, I can either get mad at them or I can learn why somebody so smart got to be that way. What's the context of which they came out of and how they were trained and generations before them were trained to put these things together. And there's a break, even though subconsciously in your programming, there's a separation. I would like to help people bridge that break and to see that it's there. Find practical ways together.
Can we talk a little bit about the biological impetus for music, how music affects our brain, how music has affected us in society? I know you talk a lot about in the book about that, and it's fascinating.
So I'm talking to the neuroscientists. So I don't know if I'm going to compete in the neuroscience realm, although I had a lot of neuroscientists involved, including our friend Daniel Levitin, who wrote the foreword, and many other people who you know. If we look at from the neurochemical state, we can affect levels of production of serotonin, dopamine. We can reduce cortisol. There's a lot of these things that we're trying to do with all these other practices that we can apply music, and that's been validated in the labs and validated in thousands and thousands of years of practice. You were talking with David Eagleman about his like creating a new sensation and how we experience and how he was helping deaf people to listen to his wristband to the skin. And I don't know if you know about the work of Nick Eberling, who built this host suit to help the deaf experience live concerts.
Yep.
Our cells create sound and receive sound. So there's two ways to look at sound in music. One is the auditory path, the range of what we have through the human ear. And then there's just the non-auditory or the things that we don't hear that are also affecting us in a sonic vibration. And that can go to an extreme, like what we can do with ultrasound and even removing possibly plaque from the brain moving forward and doing all kinds of surgeries and stuff with sound. But the auditory ranges of what we hear and can play with is also having these effects on our system. So it can make hair stand up on your skin. Right? It can, the same way it does within your ears. I wish there was a lot more studies in the biology side. I looked really deep and I go into several of them in the book, but not to the degree of which I think the potential is there. We're an electric body and basically of energy fields. And even within the stricter science sense, the nervous system, the neurological system, we can very much help regulate and stimulate and shift through musical influence or sound influence.
You make the point in the book that as biological beings, we have actually developed and evolved to have the ability to be dramatically affected by music, to be very, very strongly affected by music. And in our evolution, yes, there are a number of things that are kind of extraneous that we don't need that just came along for the ride, but possibly music isn't one of them. Possibly that deep neurological, biological understanding of music and the ability for us to be moved by it suggests that we really did co-evolve with music, that music does play a fundamental role in our existence as human beings, just in the same way that our intelligence, our taste, our sex drive, our sense of smell, that all of these other senses are meaningful and important for our survival and for our flourishing well-being.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we did co-evolve with music and we did co-evolve because of sound. We did evolve with the assistance and because of the sound of music. You have children, or you have one coming and one very active five-year-old, and they form their identities based upon relationships with music and relationships with others through music. So identity tied to what's happening with the emotions and emotional regulation and tied to what happens with the nervous system and the vagus nerve and a number of other areas of the whole system that we could get much more deeper into. Yeah, we let, as music just took over as a commodity and I won't go back to that argument so much, we kind of let these other treasures fall off the wagon, but they haven't gone anywhere. And we now have tools, technology, which we may have to do a whole nother talk on with like where we're going in the future that I'm really excited about. It's going to be music as precision medicine and personalized, and it's going to be a whole game changer for human potential. And so we have this huge wealth and this huge opportunity to take people down a path that they already love and they already have some relationship with. We just have to shift the nature of that relationship so that they see that it's there for them and it's not something they have to be at a certain level of performance or something for, that they are actually, music's there for them. Like we go through the seven phases of music, whether they need a friend, they need something to help them heal, they need better relationships with their family over the Christmas holidays, whether they want to improve their memory. It's a huge memory tool and to slow down cognitive decline and to where we can go with that. It's to build relationships with across generations where we wouldn't otherwise have communications that would get us into deep emotional places. Any one of these paths, I mean, you could basically pitch, say, okay, Frank, are you a music doctor? If you're a music doctor, tell me what I can do. I'm having trouble getting my kids and my family to connect on a deeper conversational, emotional level. All right. A 12-year-old kid can tell me their grandfather's in the hospital and they don't really know what to say to him. And the grandfather doesn't know what to say to the kid. I mean, we can open up a whole can of identity, emotional sharing, deep emotional intelligence and connection through music. Music is a pathway that would never otherwise exist in those relationships and conversations because people just don't have the tools to enter them.
A pathway that's beyond words. A pathway through which you can communicate emotion without having to say anything or share the experience or trigger the experience of emotion in ways that may be safer than words could be.
Right. Or to get into stories and histories and memories that would not otherwise be shared because they're too personal.
Can we talk a little bit about music and identity? Because I know, you know, many people, the experience of growing up as a teen and identifying themselves with their music, creating community through that music. And, you know, I am punk. I am these things because of the music.
Absolutely. So between the age of the formative years, between especially in the teenage years, so say between 12 and some people up to 25, they're still teenagers. But the development of emotional intelligence and identity is really critical, and especially in like the preteen and teen years. And so people tend to form relationships with people who have similar music. They tend to think people are cool or not cool because of what they listen to. The music that they listen to has messages that are, as you say, affirmations, but affirmations amplified because they're amplified and going into their at a whole nother neural stack on top of the messages. So they get their identity from the artists, from the messages in the music. They get their identity from the friends who they want to be friends with because of the music they're listening to or the artists they like. They get their identity with their parents because of what's played in the house, because that's part of their relationship of their connection to what their parents' identity is and the parts they want to emulate and the parts they want to differentiate themselves from, right? So what they want to be part of and what they want to be different about, they can define through music and they start to do so. People do it, again, because we're not trained in how to shape that, people do it naturally and unconsciously. And sometimes it's not for the best. Sometimes it could be, and sometimes it's just part of their journey, but it definitely shapes a child's identity, a relationship identity between a child in the world and their parents and others and their friends. And then because that's such a pliable developmental stage of the brain when it's in the formational stages, in those developmental years, the funny thing that happens is that all the music that you fall in love with then gets so deeply implanted because, as you know, when you connect an experience to a set of emotions, to a perception around it, to it goes into so many memory banks in the brain in different areas that, and it's so deeply seated that it becomes a subconscious belief system almost. If you go to a Rolling Stones concert, you're going to see everybody who was listening to that music. You'll see new fans, but you'll see predominantly a lot of people who listened to it when they were in high school and college. And that became the best music in the world for life. And they'll tell everybody.
So if music is so able to form our individual identities, it begs the bigger question of how music can then help us shape a larger global community, which is something I know you care very deeply about. In our last moments together, can you bring us out to how music can help us connect on a greater level, on a global level, and possibly solve some of the schisms that we currently have?
Yeah, so it's similar because we are a collective consciousness and a collective identity, and people try to resonate in some way with the identity and collection of at least the sector of the greater whole that they want to, right? So music has been used very powerfully in that way and can still be used very powerfully in that way to motivate the collective. I'm surprised, again, it's not used more. Last time we saw it used in a presidential collection was really with Obama and bringing the world together with the Yes We Can mantra, you know, and set to music. But Blur was very successful on the other side of bringing the people into a very formation of to rally behind things by manipulating their brains with music into a unified voice. So there's many ways. We go back to ancient China. There's a story in the book of one of the rulers long ago in BC China who used to go around and have people om or chant the five tones in Chinese to see if they're disharmonious or they're harmonious, because then he knows there's going to be a revolution. Music can be used in tremendous ways for shaping the global consciousness and for rallying people towards good, because anything that we do through word and narration and action, we can basically amplify. The title of the book, Amplified, is because we can basically add another level and deepen another deeper level into the subconscious and into the emotional body that wouldn't necessarily be there, or might be there, but could still be amplified to resonate longer, deeper, and pull people in ways that they don't even know is happening, right? Same way I do in a film score. It's like I can change the way you think and feel about anybody or anything within 60 seconds and change your belief system as you look at an image of somebody or something by the subconscious narrative I create that you don't even know is going on through the music in your brain. And when I say change the way you think and feel, I mean, the reason I bring this up is not because to be fear that we're being manipulated by these powers, but that we have these powers to shape the world in a very positive way. And that's my mission, and that's been my mission in all my work, and that's the mission of many people. But it is, as a collective, we have this very powerful mission. And again, it's when we talk about mindfulness and consciousness, it's important and beautiful to know this. You know, I've also worked with leaders to help them use these tools to bring consciousness around really important and or beautiful things that can raise people and help them to be awake. It can be a scary thought when you mention the name of somebody who's not a political favorite or not necessarily mindful and the kind of people we want to have in the world. But it's therefore even more important to know that we have this power among the collective good to expand the collective good and to unite the collective good. And to me, that's really, really exciting. So there's the expanded kind of global impact piece for those who are purpose-driven. So the third part of the book is how do we transform the world through music? And one of the big things to understand is if we talk about massive transformational purposes of entrepreneurs, the key is to going back to where we started and connecting it to your identity. So how do you connect your identity? How do you help awaken and bring your identity forth? How do you amplify it through music? How do you use that as a tool then to identify your purpose and get more intimate with who you are and why you're here? And then when you're close to that, and you're close to the source of what brings that to you, and you're guided by wanting to do massive good in the world, then you can basically take that into your massive transformational purpose. And now I have this massive transformational purpose or this calling. How do I execute it at the next level with music? How do I help myself show up as fully as possible so I have this capacity to be this exemplar, this radiating, resonating leader that can carry this forth? And music is at the intersection of those two places. There's a close on this, but there's a little piece in a chapter called Dharmani. In the Vedic terms, Dhri is the essential nature of a thing, that once you remove that, there's nothing there. So that's your identity. That's your soul. It's whatever your genius, whatever you want to call that. And then harmony is how we resonate between one or more vibrating bodies. And Dharma, which is in the middle of that, Dharmani, is our purpose in the world, right? So our capacity to ground and center ourselves and resonate in our truth and actually resonate in a vibration and using music to do that, connected to our purpose, and then connecting that purpose in a resonating and engaging way with the world, is all interwoven into music.
Wow. Well, Frank, thank you so, so, so much for inspiring within us the power of music to transform, amplify, help us discover, help us get in touch with ourselves. Thank you for giving us a taste of this journey and opening up the pathway for us to go deeper. This was wonderful.
Thank you. It's been awesome to be here. It's been awesome to connect with you. We could talk for many hours about this, and I hope to talk more.
For a lot longer. This is utterly fascinating. Yeah. So if people want to keep learning more, where can they find more of you? Where can they find more of the book and more of your music and resources?
The book it's just out, and I recommend it, not because I wrote it, but
I recommend it.
Okay, there you go. And because it's a collective work of a lot of amazing, amazing people, exemplars in the world, like Ariel. So it's at amplifiedbook.com. And then you can easily reach me at frankfitzpatrick.com. Please spread the word. It's a collective work. When we talk about the greater good of the collective, my name's on the book, but this is a collective work of many, many, many people around the world, and including yourself, Ariel. I really appreciate you being part of this.
Thank you. It was an incredibly inspiring book to read. So thank you so much. We will have all the details and more in the show notes. And Frank, it's been a joy and a pleasure. Can't wait till next time.
Thank you very much. Everybody have a beautiful day.
That was Frank Fitzpatrick. You can find him at frankfitzpatrick.com and find Amplified at all your favorite booksellers. Throughout the episode, Frank had referred to my own work in the space. I'm part of the creation of a device called Muse, which is a brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep. It gives you real-time feedback on your brain, heart, breath, and body during meditation, with soundscapes that are actually built from your biosignals to reflect back and deepen your meditation practice. It's used by hundreds of thousands of people globally, and its positive effects published in dozens of research journals. Muse's latest feature, digital sleeping pills, use audio tracks built from your body to shape sound and are designed to help you fall asleep faster and fall back asleep if you wake up at night. A recent study demonstrated that Muse's go-to-sleep experiences improve sleep quality by 20%. We're incredibly proud of the positive effect that it's having. If you'd like to learn more, we're having a deep dive event November 17th talking about sleep and how the new digital sleeping pills work. The link to register for the talks is in the show notes, or you can check out choosemuse.com to learn more about Muse for meditating and sleep.